Welcome back. Your dreams were your ticket out. Welcome back to that same old place that you laughed about. Well, the names have all changed since you hung around, but those dreams have remained and they've turned around. Who'd have thought they'd lead ya?
Who'd have thought they'd lead ya?
Back here where we need ya.
Welcome back indeed. Hello, friends. It's Todd Dolce, and I'm here today in the Blue Line Studio in Memphis, Tennessee. It's beautiful out here. Well, I'm in a climate-controlled studio, so it's always beautiful out here. I'm ready to present to you today another amazing talent in the art of cartooning and lettering, as in the case of tonight's guest. If you've ever read the wonderful comic book series from Marvel called Franklin Richards, or the hilarious webcomic called Misery Loves Sherman, well, then I guess you know who I'm talking about. And if you've been in a cave for the last few years, well, let me introduce to you my guest for tonight's show, Chris Eliopoulos. And he's an amazing talent, a prolific letterer, and he even hand letters most of his work, if not all of it. I know Misery Loves Sherman, the great webcomic at miserylovesherman.com. He hand letters that as well, and he's done some great work with another comic book series that's currently running called Pet Avengers. You've got to check him out and check out this interview. Coming up next, Chris Eliopoulos.
And what could ever lead you?
What could ever lead you?
Back here where we need you.
Back here where we need you.
What rolls downstairs, a boner in pairs, rolls over your neighbor's dog. What's great for a snack and fits on your back? It's long, long, long. It's long, long. It's big, it's heavy, it's wood. It's long, long. It's better than that, it's good. Everyone wants a long. You're gonna love it long. Come on and get your long. Everyone needs a long.
Log from Blammo.
When you've got a job to do, reach for something good to chew. Chewing helps you stand the pace, anytime and any place. So, hi-ho, hey-hey, chew your little troubles away. Hi-ho, hey-hey, chew Wrigley's Spearmint Gum. Work goes faster, smoother too. Life seems brighter when you chew. Hi-ho, hey-hey, chew Wrigley's Spearmint Gum. It's good to sink your teeth into Wrigley's Spearmint Gum. That lively flavor freshens your mouth, and the good chewing helps make the job go smoother and faster. Enjoy chewing Wrigley's Spearmint Gum every day, as millions do. Hi-ho, hey-hey, chew your little troubles away. Hi-ho, hey-hey, chew Wrigley's Spearmint Gum.
Back, and it's the Boing Podcast with Todd Dolce, your host, and we are here with tonight's very special guest, Chris Eliopoulos, and he was kind enough to give up about the better part of an hour and a half, I'd say, to share his experiences, his insight in regards to the world of comics, cartooning, and a little bit of culture thrown in there. So sit back and enjoy what I feel turned out to be a very insightful conversation with a very insightful guest. Let's start with your early influences from your childhood. Let's, if there was a pivotal moment or at what point you thought to yourself, hey, you know, I want to do this for a living. I want to create comics or cartoons for a living.
Oh, boy. I mean, I don't know if I ever fully thought I was going to do it until I was actually doing it. I guess I was either naive or just stupid. I grew up. My uncle owned a remainder bookstore, mm-hmm. And what it was is, you know, my parents would have to go and help him on the weekends just to sort of, you know, help in the his little factory, whatever it was, this little place. And he used to have these metal tin, like these metal cages almost, where they would throw like single books that were just sort of not part of a group or had fallen out or were slightly, you know, messed up. And he had a lot of these old Fawcett Dell books, like these little pocket books, you know, Peanuts and Beetle Bailey and all that kind of stuff. And so while my parents worked and helped, I was a lazy slug who just laid inside of these bins and read these books and then took them home. And so I just fell in love with comic strips and cartooning in general. And I always was drawing, and it was sort of the only thing I did. I didn't have tons of friends growing up, and I didn't go out a lot. And I spent a lot of time just sitting in my room drawing. I didn't think too much about where I was going to go with it. I just liked doing it, and it was sort of an outlet. And then when it was time to go to college, I had to make a decision what I wanted to do. And I kind of mentioned it to my parents that I was thinking of trying to figure out a way to get into comics or comic books or something. And they, of course, said, "You're insane. There's no way you can get into that kind of business. You won't make any money." And we sort of made a compromise where I would go to school for graphic design and advertising. And if the cartooning thing didn't work, I would at least have a degree in that. And
that sounds like a smart approach.
It was pragmatic. It was, you know, a parent, you know, worrying, you know. Yeah. I mean, because, you know, if you had a kid that turned around and said, "I want to go and become an actor," you'd be like, "Oh, are you kidding me?" You know, one in every 1,000 people even get a job, much less a career. So I did that, and but my real love was cartooning. I liked, you know, I didn't like the superhero stuff. I didn't really read that stuff, but I really liked comic strips and cartoons and stuff like that. So I had to go for a minor while I was in school, and I chose illustration. And a lot of the classes I wanted to take, like, you know, cartooning and sequential art, were all night classes. So I would stay. I went to school in Manhattan, so I would be there late at night taking courses. And right around the time I was asked or told by the director of our department that we needed to get an internship, I was taking a course with Gene Colan, who's a Silver Age artist for Marvel. Big guy. I mean, he's pretty famous. And I didn't know him at the time, but, you know, seemed like a nice enough guy. And he took us on a field trip to Marvel. And I asked the person, the intern coordinator, if I could submit my resume and maybe get an internship for the following semester. Which I did, and I turned in a portfolio, and they were assuming I was going to be drawing cartoons, and I gave them a whole bunch of ads and design work and stuff like that. And they said, "Wow, you can actually like work in production. You're not like one of these, you know, wannabes. You're, you know,
you can do it all.
You can do the grunt work that we need." So I got brought in as an intern. I actually interned for an editor half the time, and then I was in the bullpen half the time because they all – like, it's weird. They all wanted me. Editorial wanted me, and then production wanted me, so I sort of had to split my time. And within the first week, I was already getting freelance production work. They just said, "You know what? You know what you're doing. You're not an idiot." And I would take – you know, it's interesting at the time. Sometimes when the books were late, the lettering would be done on a separate piece of paper, and you'd have to literally glue it on to the actual art. And so it seems so bizarre to me now. I was this, you know, 20-year-old kid interning for like a week, and they're handing me original artwork from like really big names. And like, if this art got lost, it would cost a lot of money. And they were like, "Here, take it home and do this at home." And so, you know, I'd be able to sit there and look at this gorgeous artwork and, you know, slap glue on it and send it, you know, bring it back the next day, and I'd get paid. So I was actually making money in comics before I was even out of college.
That's incredible.
And then they, I guess they felt that I was doing a good enough job, and they hired me right out of college. I finished up the semester, which was the end of my college career. I didn't even go to my graduation. I went straight to Marvel. So I worked with them for a couple of years, and then I, you know, because I knew type design and stuff like that, I got into the lettering, and
That leads right to the next question, because you're really noted for your lettering. I mean, you're prolific at lettering. It's just beautiful stuff. I mean, that I was going to ask you what led to the Savage Dragon series through Image.
Well, I was I had been working for Marvel, and I had gotten enough books, because it was like a boon in the 90s. It was just there were so many books coming out, and they needed tons of work. And basically, they were giving, you know, if you could write halfway legible, they were giving you lettering work. And I had moved from production all the way up to senior letter. I was like the head lettering guy in the office within 2 years. And I was actually making more money going home at night lettering books than I was making during the day at Marvel. So I said, this is ridiculous. I mean, you know, I could spend all my time at home and make double what I'm making instead of, you know, worrying about commuting and coming back and forth to the city. So I had gotten enough books that I felt I would be safe and covered, and I gave my notice and went freelance and was just lettering a bunch of stuff at that point. And Eric Larson, who was doing Dragon but hadn't done it yet, but he was doing Spider-Man, and he really wasn't happy with the lettering he was getting, and he wanted somebody different. And they just said, you know, do you want to work on this book? Just give it a try. And so I actually went out of my way to give him what he wanted. He was very into this old John Workman style lettering, and so I would send him stuff. Is this what you're looking for? Is this? And then he was like, "Wow, you're actually committed to, you know, doing good work and not just hacking it out like most people." And I said, "Well, you know, the idea is to do what you want." So he contacted me after we had done a little series, a little Spider-Man series, and said, "I'm doing this self-published book. Would you like to letter it?" I said, "Sure." And we became fast friends, and we were on the phone like every single day. And I was lettering like, you know, a fiend for him. And next thing you know, it was like 10 years later, and we had done over 100 issues. And
that's incredible.
Yeah, so – but it was fun. I mean, we had a – you know, it was still – you know, at that time, you're still lettering on the, like, with ink and pens on the, you know, the boards on the actual artwork.
Right.
And, which was, you know, obviously more time consuming than if you were doing it on the computer. But I was at that point, I was taking everything that was given to me. Like, I didn't care. I wanted to make as much money as I could. And that meant taking everything. And there was a point where I was actually, I think, lettering about 30 books a month.
Oh, my gosh.
By hand, which was, you know, so basically you're saying it's a book a day. I was just, you know, and it only lasted a few months, but it was pretty intensive and crazy. But
it's like a marathon, and plus you didn't have the luxury of the undo button. You know, that's
oh yeah, yeah. There's no Command Z or something. You know, yeah. you know, it's you got to white it out. It's all manual. That's the difference, and that's why it's a little bit more time consuming, and you had to sort of have a better eye. You know, nowadays you can just slightly tweak something left or right, or you know, start over. And then it was like it's there.
Yep.
You know, it's on the board, and if you know, and most artists don't appreciate you taking a bunch of whiteout to their artwork and cover.
I know, it just exactly. I mean, I'm familiar with Pro White. Remember
yep.
that
yep.
stuff? Yeah.
Same stuff.
And it would dry, and you have these blobs of Pro White.
Yeah.
You're like, oh god, it looks like crap. I mean, it would in the end, it looked okay in the end result, but you're like, oh, the original looks like just looks horrid. You
yeah.
Know?
You know, and these are like, you know, I don't know if Pavement was great, and you know, a lot of these guys are reselling artwork on the aftermarket, and you know, they don't want to have like white out all over everything. Nobody wants to buy the pages with all that stuff all over it. So
right, exactly. And, well, I had one of the questions I had was kind of like discussing how you evolved from the Marvel types, you know, and then the Savage Dragon, which I think was through Image, not Marvel, but
correct.
All that kind of genre into more of the all ages, but obviously, just by hearing your first answer, talking about your how you started out there, reading the Fawcett books and everything, well, I could see where you going back to your first love being more of the all ages. And so, how did it all start? I guess like where did you first start getting to more of the all ages, and what kind of prompted that?
Well, I through my time up at Marvel, I like to do cartooning. I actually did Marvel used to have their own like self-published book called Marvel Age. It was a little magazine where they would self-publish about little articles about creators or books that were going on, and there were little bits you know, it basically had, you know, the shipping schedule, what books were coming out, and then we had a little calendar on the back cover each month, and it would be like, you know, whose birthday it was, or little almost like you know, the old Bazooka Joe comics. Like, it was sort of like these little one and off jokes in the calendar. And so I got hired along with this guy Barry Dutter to sort of write up these calendars and write gags about the superheroes and whatever it was. And so I was doing that. I was doing like little cartoons in the back of books here and there. Whenever they gave me stuff, or even in Marvel Age, to go with articles, I would do little cartoons. But that was about it. And then I really, like I said, I got heavy into the lettering, and, you know, it was sort of, you're being, you know, the money guy. You're not worried about career. You're worried about, I want to make as much money as I can. You know, I got married. Like, I left Marvel and got married within like 2 years. So, you know, you get that whole, oh God, I gotta keep making money, and I gotta, you know, provide.
Yeah, that'll do it.
And so you sort of forget that dream of yours of, you know, I've always wanted to draw cartoons, and this is what I wanted to do. And it became frustrating because, you know, you wind up chasing your tail looking for money instead of looking for what makes you happy. And so I was, again, I had become really good friends with Eric Larson, and we were chatting away and every day. I mean, you know, our wives thought we were like married ourselves to each other, because we were just – our phone bills, because he lives on the West Coast, I live on the East Coast, and, you know, we would get phone bills that were like, okay, it's your turn to call because my wife just yelled about the phone, you know, bill. And I was like, I really want to do some cartoon work. And he's like, you know what? I got pages to fill in the back of my book. I used to love the old style, you know, comic books where they would just, you know, they would have the main story, then they would have like a prose story, and then they would have some cartoons in the back. He goes, I want that. He, you know, Eric was very old school about comic books. So he's like, you know what? Here's two pages. You can have two pages every month. Do whatever you want to do.
Oh, man.
And, you know, which of course, you know, at when you hear that, you're just like, oh, my God, that's like amazing, because it's just an amazing thing. And then, of course, he waited a beat and said, okay, the first one's due tomorrow. The book's got to go. And so I literally just had to just write and draw something up really quick. I hadn't been drawing much, and I hadn't been writing, so I sort of just was like, ugh. I didn't know what to draw, and I just basically wrote up a strip based on me and an old college friend, and just wrote it up. And then what happened was, I was so busy working, it became the last thing I would do, and I would wind up every month, you know, doing these two pages like the night before the book shipped out to the printer. And but, you know, I got better and I improved, and people seemed to like it for a while. And then Eric was like, you know what, go off and do a book, you know, because considering he was one of the owners of Image, right, he was able to just say, okay, you know what, go do a book. And so I did the series, the Desperate Times series there. And then again, things started to get a little hectic, and there were issues with Image going on, and, you know, the sales were okay, and then they started to dip because something got screwed up with sale orders, and it was all convoluted stuff. And but around that time, I was starting to get more and more work from Marvel, and the then president had, you know, hired me and basically kind of gave me a contract to letter for Marvel. But he said, I like this stuff you're doing, this, you know, this Desperate Times stuff, and I want to bring it over to Marvel. And I'm like, okay. And he goes, I want you to come up with some other concepts, some, you know, all ages reaching stuff, and or whatever you want to do, you know, just pitch me and we'll start going. And so I had met up with him another day, and I pitched him the Franklin Richards idea, and he said, I don't even know who that is. Next. And I had gone through this whole rigmarole. I wrote up a whole pitch, and I'd done drawings, and I did like a mock cover, and you know, it was like, it's Home Alone meets superheroes and all this kind of stuff. And he just was not even interested. So it kind of just sat there for like a year or so, and then he left, and there was new guys in or whatever. And I was sitting in one of the editors, his name is C.B. Cebulski, who's, you know, he's sort of a talent coordinator at Marvel now. And they were coming up with a new line of kids comics, called Marvel. I think they were calling it Marvel Age at the time, but it became Marvel Adventures. And so I was like, oh, man, you guys should use this Franklin Richards pitch I had. And I started to basically just verbally pitch him on the spot. And he started making a phone call in the middle of the conversation. I said, oh, boy, I guess I'm boring him to death. And but he was actually calling the marketing guy, David Gabriel, saying we've got a new book for our line. And they basically said, okay, let's go. Start. Tell us what you want to do with this. And so I started to, you know, come up with, you know, ideas and where we were going to go with it. And then they got really nervous. They didn't know what they had. Because I was like, it's going to be like a comic strip, but it's going to be in a comic book format. And I'm going to be – and, you know, they were so used to just Spider-Man, you know.
Right.
So I was like, but it's like – it'll be like a comic book for kids. It'll be just cuter, you know, a little more simple art, and, you know. So they got a little nervous. They originally were going to give me like a 5-issue limited series. And then at the last minute, they were like, let's see what you do first. And so they said, well, why don't we just do like a couple – like a 5-page backup in these Power Pack books. And so I did them, and then they were like a little nervous. And they said, well, why don't we have somebody to script for you? And I was like, all right, whatever. I don't care. And we did that, and what happened was every review was like, who cares about the main story? The backup was the one that was good. You know, we like – this is all new. This is great. We love it. So then they said, okay, I think it's time to start doing these one-shots. And they started giving me the one-shots to do, and eventually I took over all the duties, the writing and the drawing. And
it's a phenomenal book. I mean, I loved it. I loved it. Now, you earned a Eisner nomination for that, did you not?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. And Harvey?
Yep. On the same year, the first year it came out, we got Eisner and Harvey nominations. So, which was kind of cool. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I had been banging my head against the wall, going, "I can do other things. I can do other things, and I think I can be good at this." And everybody would be like, "You're a letterer. Shut up and go letter something." And it was sort of a little bit of a vindication, saying, you know, number one, that I can do more, but also number two, that you know, people are looking for this kind of stuff and they want. Stuff that they can read with their kids, and it's not going to be, you know, violent or, you know, over the top sexually, yes. And yet they can still enjoy it. And you don't have to talk down to the kids, and you don't have to, you know, make it so inappropriate that nobody can read it. So that was the other thing. So it was a really nice thing to get going. And
so during this time, is this when you started doing some stuff for? Is it the Complete Idiot Guidebooks? Was that on the side of this? Or
yeah, it was actually right around the same time. It was interesting. I don't know. Do you know Judd Winnick? Do you know the name? Judd
no.
used to be on The Real World years ago, which is that MTV TV show, and. He was a cartoonist as well, and he had sort of been trying to break into the business. He actually did a syndicated comic strip called Frumpy the Clown.
Oh my God! Yeah, I know. Yes, yeah.
And I actually got introduced to him at a San Diego con, and I didn't know about the Real World thing. I knew about the Frumpy the Clown thing again because I was very into comic strips. I didn't know that he was on TV or all this other stuff, and so I was excited to meet him because he was syndicated, not because he was on TV. And we got into talking, and he had said, "Oh, I had this new book that I'm trying to." Get done, and I'm trying to get somebody to, you know, publish it for me. And I said, well, let me, you know, I'll bring it, you know, I'll take it to Eric over an Image, and he might be interested. And he said, like, that's great. And so I showed it to Eric, and I said, look, this is really funny stuff. It's called it was called the Adventures of Barry Ween, Boy Genius. And it's a really funny book. It's not exactly kid friendly, but really great book. And so Eric, I said, look, I think this is really good. You should publish it. And Eric said, sure, okay. So he gave the green light, and I helped Judd, and I helped him with the production end of things, and we did that. But in the meantime, he had been working on those Complete Idiots guidebooks, doing little spot illustrations and cartoons for them and stuff like that. And he said, oh, I'm getting really busy now with this other stuff. I don't want to do it. I recommended you for the gig. I was like, oh, wow, thanks, okay. And then they called and said, you know, Judd said, you're the guy, so we're going to give you a bunch of work. And they just started giving me a ton of work. I think I've done well over 300 books for them. And each book was like 5 to 6 to 7 single gag, you know, cartoons. So, you know, which improved my writing and my artwork a lot because I was drawing so many different things. You know, it was The Complete Idiot's Guide to, you know, the Great Depression. And the next thing you're doing is The Complete Idiot's Guide to playing the drums, or The Complete Idiot's Guide to, you know, a program, whatever the C++ or whatever the thing is. So I'm drawing a wide range of things. I'm trying to come up with jokes that are, you know, all over the place. And so that really helped with you know, the writing and the drawing for me.
Excellent.
And then
yes, well, now kind of going back to the all ages theme here, mm-hmm. Jenton, what frustrates me really is the fact, I mean, I grew up with very similar books that you did. I mean, we looked at the same things, it looks like, and I loved all the old Dell comics and stuff like that. And the thing that really frustrates me though now, it seems like a lot of those all ages books have kind of just disappeared from the marketplace. I mean, there's still a few titles that come out. Usually they're one shots, or, you know, they don't, or they're independents, you know. Mm-hmm. What's your thought on that? And what do you think, that's just that this is just a result of the times, you know, that kids are now engrossed in more technical, you know, apparatuses, you know, and toys, mm-hmm. and gizmos, that it's kind of just fallen behind. It's never going to,
well,
you know, catch them again. What do you think about all that?
Well, there's two different things. I mean, there's the comic book market, and then there's just, you know, books in general. I know from giving my kids' teachers copies of Franklin, the kids in the class loved it. When they had the opportunity, it was sort of like the bonus. If you did your work or something like that, you were allowed to go read a Franklin Issues book, Franklin Richards book. And that was like an incentive. You know, instead of reading a regular book, they were able to read this fun stuff. They thought it was fun and interesting. So if they're given the material, I think kids are interested in it. You know, in terms of, you know, kids' books and stuff like that. Too many people are too interested in the book market of the proper thing to do, and forgetting that the idea of a kid's book is to get them to learn to read, tell stories, or read stories. And you got to make it fun for them. You know, not just sort of the boring, like, you know, Dick and Jane books. You need something to capture their interest. And that's what I was trying to do with Franklin. I was trying to get my kids to read, you know, and be interested in reading. Because, you know, I love reading. I love stories. I love storytelling. And I wanted them to be able to have fun with it. And I think sometimes everybody forgets that kids just want to have fun. And they want to read. If the stories are fun and engaging, they're going to read them. I mean, Diary of a Wimpy Kid is out there. My kids gobble those books up.
Yeah, likewise. Same. My son does the same thing.
So it's not even the video. I mean, they'll pass up a video game to read that book.
Yep.
So because they're fun, they're sometimes a little naughty. You know, like, you know, they, you know, they do body function jokes, and that's, you know, hey, whatever, I don't care. I'm not going to, you know, qualify. If it gets my kid to read, I'm all for it. So I love that idea, and I really am trying. I'm, you know, with, luckily enough, I've been blessed that I've got a lot of work going on, so I've been busy, but I really want to get into doing sort of Franklin like books for the mainstream audience. Which leads into my other problem, which is in the comic book market. I've tried to do this because I said years ago, I was saying, you know, we're ignoring the kids. We've got the adults, we've got the teenagers, but we're ignoring the kids, and we're losing that new generation that is coming to comic books because they don't care. Like you said, they go to video games, they do this. But if you present them with something young that they're interested in, they love story. Everybody loves hearing stories, whether it's on TV or video games or whatever. And everybody's like, yeah, whatever. And what happened is we now have a bunch of comic book stores that cater to a certain demographic who are the loyal comic book readers. And those people are anywhere from, you know, 16 on up to 45, 50, who buy the same 50 titles every month. They're not interested in kids' books. They're not interested in girl books. They're not interested in anything but their superheroes. And that's what we're left with in the comic book market. You go to these retailers and, you know, instead of having these bright lit places with the comic books for kids up front where the parents can find them, they're hidden in the back in some dark corner, barely laid out, and it doesn't provide anybody a chance to go and seek them out. You know, most people don't even know there's such thing as a comic book store, much less where you would go to find one. And so we sort of lost that market, and I think some of them now are starting to realize we need to get these people back. And I mean, it seemed like right when I started doing the Franklin stuff, people at Marvel and DC started to say, yeah, you know, we need to start reaching out and getting new readers in. And you know, you see stuff like you know, Tiny Titans and the Shazam stuff, and they're, you know, Marvel's doing this Wonderful World of Oz book, which is, you know, up for Eisner's this year, and it's beautiful to look at, and it's a wonderful read, and it reaches out for that kid market. You know, Scholastic picked it up, so it's doing great. And yes, kids like to read, kids like to play video games, and they want to watch movies, and they want to do that stuff. But if you give them something that they find fun to read, I think they'll go for it. I'm not going to fall for that. You know, we're losing them because of video games.
Right. Well, exactly. And that's why I wanted to pose that question to you, because my son is 10.
Mm-hmm. Mine too.
And he is so technologically advanced, it's sick. I mean, you know, it's a different generation, but yep, he's got all the apparatus, the toys, the Wiis and all that. Yep. But at the end of the day, I don't care. I mean, when, you know, when it's his bedtime, he likes that hour of just downtime, and that's when he loves stories. That Diary of a Wimpy Kid, well, that one was over the top. He was reading that even during the day when he had free mm-hmm. time, which shocked me. I'm like, look at this,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And he loved it, and he said, Dad, when can we go to the library? I need to see if I can find some more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, he's already finished the other two books. I mean, and that tells you, just like what you said, they're still interested in that. It's just there has to be more for them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's what it is. It's people forget, you know, you got to make it fun for them. The reason they like video games is because it's fun, you know?
Right.
I mean,
yep. And you go to I don't know about where you're located, but where I'm located, there's only a couple comic book stores. One of them kind of gives that feeling like you're in a pedophile's basement.
Yeah.
It's a bad, you know?
Yeah.
And the other one is a little nicer. It's in a little better part of town, but the problem with it is we went about a week ago, and I went in there with my son, and he's looking around. He's like, Dad, there's nothing in here for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they used to have a little section in there. They had like the Scooby-Doos and the Dexter Labs, you know, and that's where we discovered Franklin, by the way. And he's looking in there now, and it's like they took that away, and maybe there's a couple Archies, whatever, but he's like, Dad, there's nothing here for me.
Yeah.
So we walked out of there disappointed. I'm like, well, at that point, I'm like, well, then I'm not going to buy anything either, you know.
Yeah.
So it's sad. Unless you go online and try to find something.
But see, that's the problem is that, you know, we should be able to make this available to people, you know, without them having to do work to find it.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, it's – people are, you know, not lazy, but, you know, if they don't know it's there, they're not going to go seeking it. And so you can't just expect people to come to a comic book store without knowing what's there to just find something that they might appreciate. I mean, like you said, I went the nearest comic book store to me is about 25 minutes from here. And I went on Free Comic Book Day, and I took my kids just, you know, you want to show support for the business and you know, and see what was going on. And I went down there, and it's a beautiful store, and it's well lit, and it's got toys on the walls, and it's got, you know, really it's clean and it's well run. And, you know, there was like – I brought my kids in, and there were, you know, a bunch of guys that were in their 30s and 40s standing around. You know, the concept is to get little kids in. You know, you bring the kids in or bring – you know, but it was the same people who were buying comic books regularly just picking up the free comic books, you know, to add to their collection. And I took the kids around and I was showing them around. I'm like, I even said, look, whatever you want a toy, get a toy. I don't care. Whatever you want, pick something out and you can have it. And they walked out with nothing. Nothing appealed to them whatsoever. You know, even the kids' books were sort of not facing out towards the door. They were, you know, sort of towards the back, you know, and they were sort of just, while everything else was stacked neatly and in order, it was just sort of like there was a section, a little, almost like those old bookshelves where, you know, you just lay them flat up, straight up and down, and they just sort of were just willy-nilly. Like, there was no rhyme or reason to them. Nothing was sticking out. Nothing was – it was just sort of like everything was tossed together. And, you know, they were like, can we go now? I'm bored. You know, and these are the same kids that love Diary of a Wimpy Kid. And if there was something that appealed to them like that in the store, I think they would pick it up. But, again, I had to drag them there, you know.
Yeah, and that's sad. And to think that they could take Diary of a Wimpy Kid. They could even put that in a comic book form. I mean, whatever. There's so many things they could possibly do. And you're right. The kids just walk out of there just, you know, this is just terrible. This is boring or, you know, and it's I don't know. And part of it, I want to attribute to the fact that it's become such a, what's the word for it? But everybody's concerned about the value of the comic. Oh, I've got number one. What will it be worth? Oh, yeah. You know, and so that takes away to me the fun of what it was all about before for kids was just reading it to enjoy it. So what if you crease the cover? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, the people that are doing that are also older. You know, right. You're not seeing a lot of kids buying. Even now you got adults who are reading comics and they're trying to bring them for their kids and they sort of do the same thing. They'll buy two copies. They'll buy a copy that the kid can destroy and the copy that they'll preserve, which is, you know, whatever. I mean, I'll take your money, but it just seems, you know, a bad lesson to learn. Like, these are just collectibles. They're not something to be read and enjoyed.
Yeah, it's kind of, and I don't want to go way off on a tributary here, but it's kind of like when I was a really avid collector of football cards and baseball cards as a kid, you know, and it got to a point where it became more of an adult hobby. They took it over.
Right.
And yes, I collected them, but I really wasn't thinking of value. I was thinking of more like, I want to get this team and that team and everybody, you know, and then, or the complete set. But then as it got more advanced, it was like, okay, all these different companies started doing all these different issues, and it's like, okay, you need this set. It got so darn confusing and expensive that I dropped out. I'm like, this is not even fun anymore. I just pulled out. I'm like, no way.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like I see that happening a little bit with comics, where it was like we just talked about the value, and or maybe how many versions of Batman or Spider-Man do you really need?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, also just the continuity alone, it's just so inaccessible to anybody new. And they keep, you know, and I hear this all over and over again from people. Well, when I started, I just picked up a comic and I figured it out as I went along.
Yep.
And you know what? It's much different these days. Like, I work on all these books and I'm all confused by them. I mean, I practically read every book that comes out of Marvel and I'm still confused, but it's playing to that market. You know, they have this demographic, like I said, and the retailers and the publishers know who they're trying to reach, and that's fine. You know, I have no problem with giving people what they want. There's certain people that this is what they want,
right?
But I think we need to offer something. Like I sort of had like this I don't know what's the term. You sort of lay down the ground rules of Franklin. I said, here's what we're doing. There's no continuity. You need to know who this guy is from the get-go. I don't want to know, you know, who knows who from what year and why, and forget it. I said, just kids don't care about that. You want to just tell the story and let them enjoy it from beginning to end and not have to, you know, have an encyclopedic knowledge of the Marvel Universe. And, you know, it made it so much easier for the kids to get involved in it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because when I read it with my son, I'm thinking, oh, God, okay. I love the look of the art. That's what pulled me in.
Right.
And so did my son, but I'm thinking, okay, now am I going to have to explain here, like Fantastic Four and all this stuff? You know, how deep am I going to have to get into this? And not at all.
Yeah.
We just got dive right in, and the little computer guy, you know, Herbie, and Wyatt just picked it up and just said, and he was so disappointed that it was a limited run, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, Dad, that's it, you know? You know?
But that's good. I mean, it's like Diary of a Wimpy Kid. You know, my kids are like, is that it? Is there another one out? Yeah, when's the next one coming out? Like, let's go. And unfortunately, you know, I mean, I'm actually sitting here as we were talking today. I'm doing a summer special that's coming out in July. That's I'm actually writing a drawing. It's Franklin and the Pet Avengers getting together. So there's a little bit more. But, you know, hopefully, you know, we can start doing some more again, or maybe something slightly different, or – you know, at least Marvel's open to it now. They seem to be much more willing to, you know, try something new and put it out there. And like I said, if I had more time, I'd probably be, you know, going crazy on it right now. But, you know.
Well, if you want to take this time here to talk about Pet Avengers, that's fine. I mean, because I've got that in here to talk about. So if you want to how that evolved and how it's going.
Well, first, it's doing very well. We just sent out to press this week the final issue of the second miniseries, and there's going to be more on the way. How it got started. I guess I should start at the beginning where how I got started. You know, I've been doing the Franklin stuff, and my editor Nate Cosby called me up one day. He's got this weird fascination with bulldogs. I don't know, whatever. And he just is like, look, I want a book about Lockjaw, who is a, again, here we go, continuity, but this giant inhuman dog that can teleport anywhere. Okay, there you go. That's bizarre. Explain that one to the kids. But he said, do a book on him, and I don't know if you want to put some other animal, some other, you know, pets or animals from the Marvel Universe. So I said, all right, you know, and I kind of came up with a story idea. And, you know, I thought, God, if it's pets, we got to go something totally bizarre and find like the worst villain ever, you know, like the most powerful guy, because it'd be just hilarious to have like, you know, the weakest characters in the Marvel Universe fighting the most powerful. And so I pitched him on it, and I picked out, you know, I said, well, I need to know who's in the Marvel Universe, because again, I don't know who knows this stuff. There are people who do, but I don't. And so they gave me a listing of all of the pets of the Marvel Universe, and I kind of went through it, and I picked out who I thought would be fun and would play off each other, and you know, and I I always learned something from every project I do. I always try to learn and improve, whether it was the Desperate Times stuff or if it was the Complete Idiots guides. I tried to learn something new and pick up something new. And on Franklin, my big thing was my first editor. Her big thing was with me was you need to create individual voices for each character. Each character needs to be their own. Like what one person says, the other person just could not ever say that. You know, you sort of have to create these personalities. And so I was like, oh, okay. You know, sort of like the Herbie is sort of very stilted and almost like, you know, C-3PO, very kind of like British butler. And, you know, Franklin's just the kid, like whatever. And so I really wanted to go into Pet Avengers and make sure that each character had their own personality. Like it wasn't just a bunch of characters, you know, who could be the same personality.
Right. It's not interchangeable.
And so I, you know, created them, you know, personalities. And I, you know, the dog is kind of based on my old dog who was kind of loving but just as dumb as a stone and just wanted to be loved. And the cat, and we all know cats are just obnoxious and, you know, only care about themselves and hate dogs and everybody else. And so I sort of built this kind of personality structure, and they loved the idea, and they said, all right, let's go do something. And we got a really good artist, this guy Iguara, on it. And, you know, I was basically told it's an all-ages book, but I also – so I kind of followed the same rules of, you know, look, I want this – I want somebody picking up this book who's never read a comic book before to know what's going on, and then just have fun with it, go crazy, just be silly and goofy, and but yet still have a, you know, a good story and be a little heartwarming at times or scary. You know, I want it to be a Pixar movie, really, and so that was my impetus. I went forward in my own head saying I'm going to do a Pixar movie in comics.
There you go.
And I think.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think what happened was there were such low expectations on this. They just thought it was going to be just the stupidest thing ever, that when the first issue came out, it was real – like everybody went crazy for it. And, you know, like there were some people who were just like, not in a million years would I ever pick up a stupid book like this. And then there were the other people who actually read it were like, wow, this is actually really, really good. Like this is a real story. This is, you know, real characters and you know – it's engaging and it's fun and it's silly, but it's also, you know, an adventure. And so, you know, we got through the first series, and everybody, by the time we were through the series, the Marvel was already saying, you know, you're going on to another series. We're going to be doing another one. So it was, you know, it's been doing really well, and people seem to like it, and we're having fun with it. And so as long as people are enjoying it, we're going to keep doing it, I think.
That's cool. Yeah. That's great. So. I kind of, when I first heard about it, I was thinking, you know, I don't know about that, you know, and I mean, being honest,
yeah.
And I looked at it and started reading a little, I said, this is really neat. It was hard to describe the art. I was trying to tell my son about it, whatever, because it's kind of like the artists, the characters are kind of somewhat realistically drawn.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not like a Hanna-Barbera style.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like, in yet, like you said, they all have their own distinct personalities. It's very well done, very well written.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's great.
I mean, he runs that fine line of it looks realistic, but you see personality in the characters' faces and attitude. It just I don't know how he does it. And it was funny when they asked us to do the second book. I'm like, I don't know if I can do it without Ig, because I mean, it's just he walks that perfect line where it looks like these are actual animals running around, and yet, you know, you see personality in them. So it's amazing to me. So.
Yeah, that's exactly how. Well, definitely want to get into your webcomic,
mm-hmm.
Misery Loves Sherman, yep. Which absolutely adore. That thing's that's phenomenal.
Thanks.
And for those of the people that are listening here that may be living in a cave, it'd be great if you could introduce that strip to everyone and just tell us what it's all about.
Well, around the time I was doing Franklin, I'm almost at 2.5 years now that I've been doing this. I've always wanted to do a comic strip, and I've always kind of – and I talked to a bunch of other web cartoonists like Scott Kurtz and Brad Geiger and Chris Straub and those guys, and I sort of asked them, you know, all the ins and outs. Their book came out, you know, How to Make Web Comics, and which was really helpful. And I said, you know what? I had gone to syndicates. I had actually taken Desperate Times years ago. As I was working on it, I sent – samples of it out to syndicates, and I got a really nice letter from Jay Kennedy at King Features, who was, you know, had given me some tips about what to do, what he thought could have been improved. But he basically, and I still have the note, I keep it posted right next to my desk, basically saying, you know, you're going to be a syndicated cartoonist one day, you've got the talent, it's just you need to find the right thing. And then at United, I actually got an email from Amy Lago, and just saying that she really loved the strip, and she wanted to work with me on it, and I said great, and we started working on it a little bit, and she'd asked for some more, like, you know, basically, can you just do these strips as strips and do some more of them, just, you know, making sure that they're appropriate for the newspaper. So I did a bunch more, and she loved them, and she's all right. And we were getting to the point where she was like, basically saying, you're going to be getting a contract this week. Get a lawyer. We'll start, you know, making plans. And I guess the way the story went, so I'm sitting there going, oh my God, I'm going to be a syndicated cartoonist. She took the strips that I had done and brought it to the sales folks to say, okay, well, how are we going to market this thing? And the VP of sales looked at it and said, you know what, it's just another bachelor strip. We have we have other bachelor strips. I can't sell this. Kill it. So she actually had to call me up and say, like, I'm really sorry. You know, we can't go forward. But she goes, I really think this is a strip that, you know, you need to be syndicated. You need to do this. And she passed me along to – I've never heard of this before. Her old boss had moved on to a different syndicate, and she mailed her the strips and said, we were about to go for this, but, you know, maybe you'd be interested, that, you know. And so the woman contacted me and said, I'd like to work with you on this. And I said, okay.
Wow.
And basically had said, you know, here's what I need from you, and basically started to set down ground rules. Like, she's like, okay, you can't have more than 40 words per strip. I'm like, I'm sorry, what? She goes, no more than 40 words on a whole strip. You cannot have more than that. I was like, okay. So I did a bunch of strips up with less than 40 words.
Oh, God.
Then she's like, you know, you need to go a little bit less racy with your humor. I went, okay. She goes, do a bunch of samples that are a little bit more, you know, this, and this went on for like a couple of months where, you know, without a contract, without, you know, development deal, I'm just doing these things on the side. I'm just, you know, giving her, you know, what she's asking for. And she's like, you need to be less controversial. You need to like calm down. You need to do this. You need to do this. And by the end, even I was looking at it going, this is like the same boring stuff you see everywhere. It has no personality to it. And she I think she emailed me at one point and said, the strip lacks any personality. I don't think we can move forward with this anymore.
Oh no.
And I was like, but you asked for this. And so, yeah, you know, whatever. So God. I said, all right, you know, so I said, I really want to do this, but, you know, obviously maybe syndicates aren't the way to go, or maybe I'll just work on a strip and get better at it. You know, again, you know, a lot of guys, I read or I see people online going, I did 8 strips. I'm going to send it to the syndicate and be done with it. And they think there's like a shortcut or an easy way in, and there really isn't. And I thought, well, you know what? I'm just going to keep doing as much as I can and just keep doing it and get better, improve. Forget about getting syndicated. Just I want to get better. And so I just started doing the strip and, you know, put it up on a website and started going. I just said, look, I'm going to be professional about this. Even if I'm not getting paid for it, even if I'm not, you know, making a dime off of it, I'm going to make sure that I put out a strip every day, 5 days a week. And go. And if some of it's bad, some of it's bad. I'm not going to blow a deadline. And I actually did that, except for 1 week. I had two guys that worked for me doing lettering. One had went on vacation. The other one was out sick for a week. And I had to cover them for that week. And I missed 4 days of the strip. So over 2.5 years, I've missed 4 days. But I just kept working at it. And I said, you know, I sent off samples to the syndicates of what I was doing, and, you know, they all came back with the same thing, you know, no thanks, you know, not working for us. I got like a handwritten note. I keep it. It's funny. I got a Harvey Award, and which is great. You know, you sit there and you look at the award and say, this is wonderful. I got an achievement. And I, just to keep myself on level, I put the rejection slip in the Harvey Award. Just to sort of remind me. And so, you know, and now the newspapers are kind of going the way of the dodo now. So, you know, there's not going to be really a place for syndicated comics in newspapers, and at least not enough to make any kind of real money. So I do the strip. It's basically similar to Franklin, because I figured if I could take that audience that follows Franklin and bring it into the strip. So it's about a young boy and a couple of aliens and the embodiment of death living with him, which is nothing like Franklin. But so, you know, and it's just basically, you know, these weird personalities, again, trying to make sure that they each have a unique voice and personality, and try to keep it funny. Like I try to, you know, and I take a lot of my everyday life and put it into the strip. So a lot of it is me mocking my own neuroses and problems.
So, you know, you obviously like coffee then.
Oh my God. I'm sitting here drinking a cup of coffee every time. I mean, you know,
yeah, just the last few weeks with Zort, with the coffee, I've got a guy that I work with next who sits next to me, who's a big coffee drinker. I don't drink it, but he does.
Right.
So I keep sending him the strip, whatever. Now he's into the strip.
Oh,
so,
good.
By the way, yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, it's funny. One of my friends just he looks at me and he goes, "When you're in psychotherapy, all I'm going to do is hand them your strip because it's everything that's wrong with you is right there." Because you know the people that know me know they see it. You know, right in there, they see the mess that I am. But so it is like a sort of therapy for me too. So it keeps me laughing at myself and not taking it too seriously.
I see a lot of influence of Fran, who is the Sherman's sister.
Right.
I see a lot of that. You may disagree with it, but I see Lucy from Peanuts in there. Just a little.
Yeah,
no.
It's funny. I grew up obviously loving Peanuts, and I always related to Linus. My sister was a brute to me, and I used to like relate. You know, because I was very quiet and very sort of thoughtful as a kid. And my sister was just like, she'd walk into the room and just beat me up and walk out again. And so I related so much to Linus in the strip. Like, I, you know, she was just like that. And in the strip, you know, the characters are sort of loosely based on my life, you know, and my sister is sort of was like that as a kid. You know, she was just, I mean, obviously not to the extremes of, like, you know, the way Fran does, but you know, she was a very similar. So yes, they are very similar, and because growing up, that they were very similar. So,
do you see? I mean, I know you're producing Misery, Love Sherman, for the love of it right now, and it's, believe me, we're all thankful you're doing that because we get to enjoy it. So it's kind of selfish for me, but do you see? I mean, or how do you see the internet in the future of being, I mean, is there going to be a business model here that really will work for work like this? I know there's a few out there that, you know, like the Scott Kurtzes of the world that are saying that they're making a good living on it. And that's, of course, that term living is subjective. But where do you see it going? Is there going to be a way to market this without just going through Cafe Press and trying to sell shirts and stuff and pimp it that
way?
You know?
I mean, yeah, it's weird. The things I've learned, and if I went back, I don't know if I would do the strip the way I'm doing it right now. What I've discovered with the internet is the people that are making the money, or the strips that are succeeding, are appealing to those heavy users of computers. The video game market, you know, the scientist, mathematician, computer nerds. If you look at the big strips that are doing really, really well, you know, it's Penny Arcade, which appeals to video gamers, PvP, which appeals to, you know, basically got people involved because of the video games. XKCD is very a mathematical thing. So, you know, it's sort of the early adopters of new technologies are loving these strips, and that's why they're doing really well. I think for web syndicated strips, what you need to do is find a niche market. I've noticed, like, there's a strip out there, it's called Unshelved, and it's all about librarians. It's all about a library and a librarian, and it appeals to that market, and they seek out that little demographic. I think web strips need to be a very niche thing in order to succeed. But it does involve, you know, I mean, I know Bill, who is the creator of the strip, runs around to all these conventions, all these book expos, all these librarian conferences, selling books and stuff. So it's a lot more work than just sitting around and drawing a strip and mailing it to a syndicate and having them distribute it. Yep. It becomes, you know, this is your career, and it involves marketing and travel, and, you know, you have to be your own salesperson. And I have a lot against me in that. I'm not very niche oriented. I don't have the time to run around the country going to conventions. Besides the strip, I'm writing, drawing books for Marvel. I'm lettering a bunch of books. I've got a company that letters a bunch of books. I got five guys working with me. So I don't have that luxury. And, you know, not to mention a wife and kids who, you know, I don't want to be away all the time.
Right. Exactly.
So I don't have that luxury of being able to go around all the time and selling. You know, I printed books and I made plushes and I offer them for sale on the web. And, you know, I don't get a lot of sales. I mean, there's not a ton of, you know, people running out to buy the books and get the plushes, even though they all promised me they would. But, you know, I understand it. You know, people, unless, again, like a comic shop, unless you're able to just say, here it is, most people don't want to buy. Like, I went to a convention a month or two back, and I sold as many books at that show as I did total online. Over, you know, a 6 month period. So, you know, I could have gone through Amazon, but Amazon wants to take 80% of your sales money.
Right.
And then you still have to mail it out yourself. So, you know, that they get you there. So there may be a way to do. I mean, Dave Kellett does Sheldon, and he seems to be doing fairly well. I mean, I don't know his numbers, and I would never be rude enough to ask him what he makes, but he seems to do well enough that he keeps going. He publishes books and he sells them, and his book, you know, his strip is not very niche oriented, so he's doing it.
Right.
So
it just seems to me that I mean, part of me thinks there needs to be maybe some kind of governing body that a syndicate that on the web it just takes over and everybody goes through that submission process. So there's some kind of quality check. But then the other part of me is like going, but that's kind of the old model that,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know what's right or wrong, but there seems, I don't know the way it should go. I just think there has to be some kind of, dare I say, yeah, governing body,
yeah.
Someone to say this is well, good quality stuff.
Yeah, that's the problem too. Is, you know, everybody, it's weird. Comic books. When you say comic book, most people have this preconceived notion that it's stupid kiddie stuff that's just not for any rational human being. You know, it's for stupid people, or you know, it's lowbrow entertainment. And no matter what we do in the business, it still has. I mean, you put out Iron Man, you put out Spider-Man, the movies, and if you hand them a comic book, they go, ugh, I don't want to read this. It's stupid. But they're spending millions at, you know, at the movie theater. When you hear webcomic, most people think, you know, a badly done strip that couldn't be syndicated because it's just so bad.
Exactly. And free.
And free. And so, but, you know, again, with the web, everything is, you know, we're now at a point where everybody expects everything to be free on the web. You know, nobody wants to pay for it. I mean, you've seen what goes on. I mean, the New York Times, they decide to put, you know, all their content behind a paywall, and it bombs. People go, I'm not going to pay for that. You look at who else was doing stuff. Hulu was providing free content, right? You're able to watch TV shows for free. They announce that they're going to start charging, and everybody loses it. I'm not paying for this. They run off in droves. Nobody wants to pay for anything on the web. Now, these guys have, you know, basically found the little – thing that works for them, where, you know, they put out the strip for free and then they charge for other things, which is not a bad way to go. And, you know, and I don't particularly like the idea that people keep saying they're just t-shirt salesmen, because they're selling the whole package. They're selling the, you know, the cult of personality, as it were, the sort of the, you like this world that I'm creating, my personality, my little, what I have to say, you know, you'll like to pick up my books, you'll pick up my t-shirts, you'll pick up other things and show support that way, and show your, you know,
sure,
your love that way. So I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, you know, I think it's weird that syndicated cartoonists look down on it, because basically all they're doing is they're giving it to the syndicate, and the syndicate, you know, they're giving it to the syndicate for free, and the syndicates are selling it, and they're making money that way, and then they're making, you know, licensing deals. So it's sort of similar, you know, but the problem is that, yeah, a lot of people assume, and they're right, most strips are really, really bad, you know, and they are. There's a lot of really just amateur hour stuff going on.
Right.
And sort of that's why I went into it with the thought that I'm going to be as professional as I am with this strip, as I am with my paying work. You know, I think if people are, you know, willing to come to your site, you should have it when you say you're going to have it there, you know, and it's going to be quality and it's going to be the best thing you can do. Now, you know, 2.5 years later, you know, I've got better numbers, but I'm not getting a lot of people buying. I'm not making a lot of money off the strip. And, you know, if it came to the point where I just went, you know what, I'm tired of this, I'm not making any money, I'm not getting any fulfillment out of it, then I'm going to stop. But I mean, luckily enough, I'm still getting my own personal fulfillment out of it. So, you know, unfortunately, you know, I there's not a lot of people that are, you know, seeking out. Again, here we go. You know, what we're doing in a sense is putting the onus of the work involved to find it on the reader. And maybe that's where, you know, you're saying there's got to be some kind of syndicate that sends it to them. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of people that go to Go Comics or comics, you know, .com to seek out strips, except for people that are really interested in it.
Right.
You know, there's got to be, like, you know, a syndicate that turns around and says, I'm going to market this strip exclusively to, you know, Amazon, or I'm going to exclusively submit it to, you know, USA Today Online, or, you know, something like that, where there's a unique place that you can't get it, like 50 other places, like syndicated strips. You can go to every different – if you can't get it on their, you know, thecomics.com, you can go to any number of newspaper websites and find the strip, you know.
I'm not a big – just – you're going to – let just tell you how far behind I am. And I have a tablet PC. I mean, I get into a lot of the technology too. But recently, just because of my son, he dragged me into an Apple store kicking and screaming. Mm-hmm. But I went in anyway and looked around, and I started – I was really getting fascinated. Why not maybe come out with some kind of – well, it seems to me, backtrack, that – people have no problem, even kids have no problem spending 99 cents for an app, you know, an application.
Yep.
Somehow, maybe they need to work something in there that, okay, this is where all the kids are going. They're buying these iPod Touches, whatever,
right,
or iPads. There seems to, maybe there's potential there. There's some way that they can, like a syndicate or whatever, can go and provide some of this good content in these apps. So then now they're paying for them, you know?
Yeah. I know they, like Scott Kurtz has got an app for his strip that you can, you know, it's a free app, but then he's got like links to the store. Mm-hmm. So you get the strip every day if you want on your iPad, but then there's a store and then there's other stuff that you can look at on there. There's, you know, there's a couple of apps called like that Comixology does, where it takes, you know, comic books and it provides, and some of them are free. So that's there. But again, you know, how many people are buying iPads, and how many people are willing to sit down and read a strip on an iPhone?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what it was with the newspapers was, it was there. You were getting it. Basically, it was like bonus material. Like you were buying it for the news, and then, oh, I got these strips as well.
Right.
And, you know, if you liked them, you read them. If you didn't, who cares? It was a 25-cent newspaper.
Well, right. But – and there was another – I had another interview a while back where we talked about that. We talked about maybe digital newspapers, you know, where they have the – I think it's OLED technology. You can actually roll it up.
Mm-hmm.
Why not have everybody – you know, I don't know why these newspapers – aren't going to that, or maybe they are, and it's just really unaffordable. But have something where, you know, everybody who subscribes to the paper gets these digital sheets, and they can every day they can choose to, like, these different packages. They can upload the comics they want instead of, you know, how you go now. It's like if you like Mallard Fillmore, but you know what? People in Colorado get it, but you don't get it because you live in Memphis or whatever. You know?
Right,
so
right.
But having a digital content would I don't know.
It yeah. seems like, it's really tough in a number of ways. Well, if newspapers are not going to, you know, newspapers don't want to pay for anything these days. I mean, they don't even want to pay for the content that they're getting because they can't afford it. I mean, they're just not making enough money anyway. The syndicates, I don't think. You know, I mean, I guess they could try to do it, but they're already offering it online for free. So what are they – you know, if you go to Go Comics, it's like, you know, there's 100-and-something strips on there. Again, people have to kind of wade through the whole thing trying to figure out, you know, which strips they like, which they don't. I mean, that takes a lot of time and effort.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, it's they want – everybody wants ease of access, ease of, you know readability. They don't want to pay for it. And, you know, and then so the syndicates say, fine, I'll send a package, you know, a digital page of stuff out to you. Nobody's really going to pay for it because they're not getting anything really for it. You know, I mean, because you can go to Go Comics and you can set up your own page. You can set up which strips you like and you can go through them and you can, you know, pick the ones you like, and then every day you could go, and that every time they update, you'll go to that page and it's there. But nobody makes any money. I mean, they have a little bit of advertising, but then the syndicate takes most of it.
Right.
And, you know, these guys aren't making any money, you know. And so, you know, it's hard to keep doing this if you're not making a lot of money on it. You know, I luckily enough have a career on the side where I'm, you know, I'm doing other things that make me money, and I can afford to do a strip, but not a lot of people can do that.
Right.
So, you know, it's a real tough nut to crack. I don't know. you know, what the answer. I mean, I know there's been people who tried to do apps where they grab, you know, the Strip's RSS feed and offer it that way. So you buy, you know, web comics, you know, app, and then in there there's like 50 or 60 web comics, and every time they update, you get them, you know, in there. But they're not going to the producers of the comic strip and asking permission. They're not even paying them for it, because they're just – it's just an aggregator. It's just an RSS aggregator, and, you know, so nobody's making any money. So you're providing free content for this guy to make money for his app that he created. So, you know, it's – there's large problems, it seems, everywhere.
It's almost like you have to – you're going to have to offer something that you just can't get, you know, everywhere else.
Yeah.
And offer it, but then it goes back to then how do you reach those people? Because I'm like you. I don't have the time to sit there and Google this and Google that, or what do you Google if you don't know what's out there?
Yeah.
Or go to these other sites. I'm like, I just don't have time. So maybe there's two or three that I look at consistently.
I mean, but you got to seek them out, or somebody's got to show them to you, or most people aren't. I mean, there's people that are into comic strips or cartoons or comics or whatever, and they're going to look for this stuff. But I mean, if you Google search, you know, web comic, you come up with thousands of hits.
Right.
And imagine trying to wade through that, trying to figure out where the good ones are.
Yeah.
I mean, that's daunting, you know,
And right. I wouldn't even know about Misery Loves Sherman, to be honest with you. I kind of went to that through the back door of Franklin Richards, and then Googling your name, and then that's one thing led to another. But I never would have sought it out, you know.
Right.
I wouldn't know. It's I don't know. It's tough.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, it's almost like you have to put advertising out there to get people to come and look, or you know. But even that, you know, I've done stuff where I do a guest strip for somebody. Like I've done a couple for Kurtz, and the numbers skyrocket for that day or two, where people come flooding to your site and they read the whole backlog of strips, right, and then walk away. You know, like, okay, that's great. Thank you. Moving on.
Yep. Got what I needed.
Yep. And that's it. And that's sort of the thing. It's just onto the next thing, onto the next thing, onto the next thing. And it's hard to get people to come and then to stay, you know? So, I mean, I guess what's good, everybody keeps saying what's good is that I have a consistent number, and with web strips, it seems to be that's what you need. You need a loyal core of people rather than a disloyal large amount of people, you know. So you've got – if you've got, you know, 50 people that are really passionate about your strip and buying and sharing with others, they're a lot better than, you know, 1,000 people that are sort of indifferent to the strip, because, you know, they're not really going to share with other people. They're not going to be, you know, willing to buy anything. And, you know, so my thought has been just keep putting out – try to put out quality stuff, and if – people like it, they stick around. And my numbers are practically like rock solid every single day. Like, I don't see much – I haven't seen much change. I mean, they uptick a little bit over time. But they've been fairly consistent, which, I mean, I guess says to me that whoever finds it likes it and sticks around.
Oh, absolutely. It's such a great – I'm putting a note here, by the way, to buy something from Chris's store. Okay.
Hey.
I've got to do it.
No. I mean, you know, like, and I understand that too. It's hard for people to, you know, I've tried to make it as easy as possible. Like, I was even going to do the store, like, just, I was going to put it up for sale, you know, stuff for sale on the site, and then just PayPal me the amount and your address, and we'll go. Well, people get nervous. They go, well, I don't know really who you are, and I'm not going to willing to just dump, you know, $30 or whatever the amount or whatever they're going to give me, you know. So I went through this company called Shopify to make sure that, you know, you could pay for this and not worry about it, you know, and feel secure. Nobody cares. I was talking to Brad Geiger about it, and he's got this theory, and I thought it was a little wrong, but he's absolutely right. Basically, if you look at your numbers, you're going to get about 10% of those people are going to be willing to buy something. You know, so if you have 1,000 people, you know, that's not really a large amount of people that are going to be buying stuff from you. You can't really live off of 100 people buying a book.
Right.
You know, especially when, you know, printing a book costs a lot of money. you know, if you're going to do it right. Like, I sent it off to a printer, and, you know, to print a book up, 128 pages, it's 12 by 12 book. You know, you're talking, I don't remember, what was the total amount? It was a few thousand dollars. You know, so I'm outputting a bunch of money with the hopes that people are going to buy. And if they don't buy, if I don't get the right amount of people, you know, I'm sitting on, you know, and a lot of people can't do that. A lot of people can't afford to do that. So there's, you know, that fear that I'm going to lay out this money and not get the return on it. So, you know, so it's a catch 22 all the way through, and, you know, and it's tough. And, you know, if I had more time to devote to publicity and promotion, I would, you know, I would do that, because I think that's a lot of it as well, is dealing with that. So, you know, it's tough. I mean, it's not an easy thing, and you're not going to become the next Penny Arcade or the next PvP, you know, right off the bat, like everybody thinks they are, you know.
So are you working several days or weeks ahead in Misery, or is this day to day? What's your routine with it, and what materials do you use, and the process behind it? Explain that if you can.
Well, lots of coffee, as you mentioned right off the bat. What I do, I try to stay ahead. A lot of times, though, it's all dependent on my other work schedule. You know, if I've got other books that I'm working on, I'm writing, drawing, lettering, obviously the writing work takes priority. I do like to be a couple of weeks ahead, because you never know what will come up, especially with work and life in general. So I'm always trying to stay ahead. Lately I've fallen behind just because of people going on vacation, because now everybody's starting to go on vacation. The guy's working for me, and so I have to cover their work and do that kind of stuff. But what I normally do is I'll sit down. I usually try to do it in the morning. I'll get a cup of coffee. I put on some heavy music and, you know, basically just jump around like a fool, getting the blood flowing. You know, you sort of get you just loosen up and let it all go. And usually I kind of have an idea for where I'm going to go with a week's worth of strips or an ongoing thing. I don't really plot it out. I just go, I want to discuss coffee drinking, because I'm an idiot, because I drink it like it's a drug. And I laugh about the idea of that, you know, why aren't there like interventions for coffee drinkers, or why isn't there, you know, a Betty Ford for coffee drinkers and stuff like that, and how like Starbucks is like a cult, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it sort of rolls around, and I write it down, you know, wherever I am, and I kind of have a basic premise of where I'm going to go. And then I try to incorporate the personalities of the characters into it, like who would be like this, and what would this person's response be, or what would this character's, you know, attitude be about this. And I sort of just start thinking about it and picturing the scene in my head. Where would it go? You know, if so-and-so did, you know, this, what would so-and-so's reaction be to that? And then just sort of mull it around and kind of come up with, you know, a punchline to it all, like a funny play on words, or a funny, you know, what I find funny, what makes me laugh. You know, I write it down, and then I move forward and then do the next strip. Usually I like to do like at least a whole week's worth of strips written out in one sitting, so that at least I've got that. And then I can, you know, to draw a strip up, it'll take me like an hour, and I can fit that in between things. Like if something's uploading to a server, or if something, I can just go off and I can just, you know, draw up a strip for an hour. I work on – I found this paper from BlueLinePro.com. It's a Strathmore – I think it's 500 series. It's 3-ply. It's really thick. It's heavy. It's really like, you know, like you can hold it at one edge and it almost stands straight like cardboard. It's really good paper. I pencil it in blue non-repro pencil, in a mechanical pencil. I do the borders with a rapidograph, as well as the lettering. I use a globe point, a Hunt globe point pen for the ballooning. And then I ink with a Raphael 8404 number one brush,
That's cool.
Yeah. So, and then that's about it. I mean, and I just go through it. I bang it out.
Anybody that can use a brush, that's just amazing to me. I struggle. I still, every now and then, I break them out and try, and I'm like, God, this is just, you know, I'm like, man, it must be the hairs in the brush. You know?
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah. It's funny. The one, I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing, is I'm tenacious when it comes to stuff. Like, when I start to learn something, I don't stop until I can figure it out. It was funny because I had a guy working for me years ago who was like, you must really love lettering because you really try your best to do, you know, everything the best that you can. I said, no, that's it's not the lettering I'm interested in. I just want to master that craft. I want to be the best I can. And so I had picked up a brush, and I'm like, I really want to learn. And I was horrible. I mean, it took me a long time to really figure this thing out. And
now, it's funny. I'm so glad you mentioned the paper. I was at a local store yesterday because here's the problem I'm having. I haven't tried that 3-ply 500 series, but I've tried some other boards. I'm having a problem with, and I don't know if it's the ink or if it's the paper or if it's a combination of both, but either it doesn't dry fast enough or it feathers or I'm at a point where I'm trying different paper, and then I'm like, well, maybe it's not the paper, maybe it's the ink. So then I'll get Noodler's ink. Mm-hmm. Obviously by looking at your work, it's smooth as silk. So what ink are you using with that board?
I'm just using Speedball, indie ink. It's you know, it's also, it depends on the, if you're using a certain pen, you know, you got to be careful that you're flicking it on a toothed paper. I love the Strathmore paper. I think it's the finest paper. So you could even do 300 or 400 series. The brush, again, you have to learn. It's funny. It's an all new way of doing things. The way you work with a pen or, you know, a Croquel is totally different from how you go with a brush. And what's funny is, you know, I've got a Cintiq now, and if anybody doesn't know what that is, it's sort of it's basically a monitor that you can draw on electronically. So I can go into Photoshop, and I've done this where you draw, like I know Scott Kurtz does this, and you basically, it's like drawing on a screen. And in Photoshop, they have these brushes, but the brushes do not behave like real brushes. They behave like Croquel pens. So I went into it with the mindset I have to draw like I do with a brush, because you know there's certain directions you can go with a brush. If you brush outward, they kind of flay out and you don't get a clean line.
Yes.
So you can't really sort of go right to left. You can't go, you know, down to up. You sort of have to always remember to keep going the other direction. You have to go up to down or left to right, and you know, kind of work around a curve with that. But you don't have to worry about that on the computer, and it sort of, it acts more like a Croquel. So now my new thing is I'm trying to master drawing on the computer, but a lot of this stuff is also trial and error and practice. You know, I mean, my biggest issue I have with a lot of people, especially, you know, I deal with a lot of people who are trying to get into comic books, and they're always asking, how do you get into comic books? How do you break into comic books? And really what they're asking is, how do you break into the mainstream comic book thing? Isn't there like a secret handshake? Isn't there like something going on? But, you know, I read a book recently. It was called Talent is Overrated. And it's a book about the people that you know, who have achieved most in life aren't extremely talented, or they're not better naturally than anybody else in whatever discipline they're going in. But what it is it takes a real passion for whatever they're doing, and a lot of time and a lot of dedicated practice. You know, I worked like a fool to get better, you know, working with a brush. I worked like a fool to get to be a better writer. You know, I've been in the comic book industry for 20 years, and only after 20 years am I finally starting to get work, you know, unsolicited, where I don't have to go and beg for work. They kind of come to me and say, oh, we want you to write this a story for me, or I want you to do this. So it takes a lot of work, you know, and that's why I did the strip, is I want to get better at doing this. I want to be really good at doing a comic strip. And it meant I've got over 600 strips I've done. And I'm not even close to satisfied with it. Every day I look at the strip. I finish up the strip. I always have this moment. And maybe I'm a drug addict now because I live for this moment where I finish it and I go, ah. And like 2 seconds later, I go, ugh, look at this. I messed this line up and this is not funny. And I could have rewritten this way. And so it's that one little moment where I'm really happy with what I do. And then I'm never happy again until the next time I get to that point. I'm always trying to get better. I don't think I'm ever going to be as good as I want to be. And I think that's what a lot of people forget is that there is no easy road to anything. There's no easy road to learning how to do a brush. You just practice day and night. There's no easy way to break into the business. There's no, everybody can mock Scott Kurtz for whatever you want to mock him for, but it wasn't easy for him. You know, he worked really, really hard and to get to the point where, you know, he's known and, you know, as a good cartoonist who does really good work. And it didn't happen overnight. You know, I mean, he's at this 10 years now. So, you know, I think everybody seems to forget that they think there's just like, you know, here's my work and I'm ready to go. You know, if you think if you ever think you're good enough, you're not good enough.
Yep.
You know, I've never been satisfied ever with my work.
It's funny how a lot of people can understand. It's like, look, if you want to get the Mr. Atlas body, you're going to have to work out, and you're going to have to work out several days a week, and you have to train those muscles and do this repetition. But then but for some reason, that mindset or that understanding seems to fall apart when it's like, well, I want to be syndicated. You know, what's like you said, what's the magic trick? You know, what do I have to do to do this to get there? It's like, well, it's no different than trying to build your muscles, you know?
Well, I mean, you look at it the same way. It's even weight loss, if you want to use that analogy. Most people are looking for the pill or, you know, they want that little something that'll just make them lose weight as opposed to, you know, everybody for the last 2,000 years has said, eat healthy, exercise, you lose weight.
Right.
And everybody goes, oh, I just can't seem to lose the weight. Well, you're eating buffalo wings and you're sitting on the couch. I mean, you can't expect to, you know, there's no secret answer. You can't just, you know, everybody's looking for that quick and easy way of doing things. And it doesn't happen. I mean, like this book was saying, like, you know, Tiger Woods, everybody goes, oh, he was just a natural talent. No, he looked up to his father who liked to play golf and who was a coach for kids. He taught kids how to, you know, play baseball and stuff like that. And he coached his kid to play golf. And the kid was doing it every day from the day he was like 2 years old.
Right.
He didn't become a world-class talent and win things until he was like, you know, 21, 22. Well, between the ages of 2 and 21, you know, he did a lot of improving. He practiced every day. You know, he wasn't born – you know, and 2 years old winning, you know, professional tournaments.
Right.
So
it's kind of like being an overnight success. Unfortunately, it took about 30,000 nights.
Right. Right.
You know.
No, you're exactly right. So, you know, it's tough. I mean, I feel bad because people think that, you know, I have the secret knowledge that I can impart. And it's funny because I've told people, I'm like, you got to work really hard. Ah, you just don't want to tell me. And they walk away all angry. And I'm like, I'm sorry. And, you know. I worked like a fool in high school to get into college. I worked like a fool in college and got into Marvel. I worked like a fool at Marvel. I worked day and night, and I, you know, there were times where, you know, I was freelance, and I went out. It was a Friday night. I went out with some friends. We had dinner or something like that. I'm like, all right, I got to go home. I got work to do. And they're like, it's a Friday night. I got work to do. You know, I gave up those Friday nights. I gave up the, you know, the free time to get better and to do better. And, you know, that's what people don't see.
Do you find yourself liking the Cintiq more than the traditional pen and paper, or do you still kind of like, you know?
I will put it this way. I like working on the Cintiq, but the strip is my passion, and I do it the way I love doing it, and so I work with pen and with brush and ink. So, I mean, I do work on the Cintiq, and I enjoy doing it. It's very interesting. Again, like I said, it's something I really want to master, and I want to get better at it. But I really just do love working with ink, and I like the happy accidents that come of, you know, working with ink, and
exactly,
you know, which is,
I was just going to say that happy accidents can happen with the traditional way.
Yeah, and sort of like the constant undo button can save you from those happy accidents, because you go, oh, well, that didn't look right, let me fix it. Whereas, you know, with ink, you're sort of like, well, that looks okay. Like, I'm going to let that go. So, you know.
So what do we see? What's in the future for you? What?
Well,
that maybe you can share. Other than, I know you're working on that. You were talking about that summer project there right now.
Yeah, it'll be out in July. It's called it's like Pet Avengers Dog Days of Summer. I think it's called. It's just there's going to be a lead story involving the Pet Avengers, and Ig is drawing it, and I'm writing it. And then I'm doing like a 15-page backup, which is Franklin and the Pet Avengers, and then which is going to lead the first story is going to lead into hopefully another Pet Avengers, which isn't announced yet, so I'm not saying it or confirming it, but we'll see. What else am I doing? Writing some other stuff here and there, actually doing continuity work with the Marvel Universe. Go figure. And working on the strip, but I'm also I started working on it's sort of like I said, a Franklin, but its own little world. Like it's basically a kid's comic book, so it'll sort of have the same feel as Franklin. So I'm gonna do that, and then I'm gonna try and sell it to traditional book companies and get that out into the mainstream bookstores.
Excellent.
Because I mean, you know, even if Marvel's not going to do Franklin, I really want to provide this kind of stuff, you know, which I think if offered like Diary of a Wimpy Kid, people, you know, kids might be really interested in. So
that's great news.
Yeah.
Super.
So,
well, hey, we're already at an hour and a half. Oh, man, I took a lot of your time up there, but I really, really appreciate it, Chris.
My pleasure.
I'll try and get this compiled and ready to go online, and I may pull some artwork, images, whatever, off of your site.
Of course.
So just so you know, I want to
pull
some stuff just to have some visual references and everything. And,
perfect.
Yeah, it's been great. I really, really appreciate
my
it.
My pleasure. Anytime.
So, but I will let you go. And
thank you, sir.
Thanks again. Yeah.
And hopefully I'll talk to you soon.
Yep. Thanks.
All right,
Chris.
Man. Later.
All right,
bye.
Well, that, my friends, concludes yet another Boing podcast, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, despite some of the echo that was going on there from the Skype recording, but it's been well over an hour and a half. I've got to run, so you guys take care. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll try to be back again sooner rather than later this time, and with another in-depth interview with another fantastic cartoonist professional. So thanks again, guys. Gotta run. Have a great week. Have a great month. Talk to you later. Bye.